Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live from Alberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on the Heritage Radio Network, every Tuesday from roughly 12 to roughly 12:45 or 1, something like that. Hey, Stas, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing all right, joined as usual with Nastasha the Hammer Lopez and the guys in the engineering booth. How you guys doing over there?
Just Jack today.
Just Jack?
Old school.
You know, no offense to anyone else, but, you know.
I like Just Jack.
Feels good to have the Just Jack.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, Jack's the man. Jack Inslee, a.k.a. the man. You got anything good going on the Heritage Radio Networks that we need to know about?
New website launch.
Yeah? When is that going to happen?
It's up.
When did it go up?
We had a little soft launch happen last week, and it's up now. We also have our own kind of like storefront in the iTunes store now. So you can see Heritage Radio Network has its own kind of channel. And right now on the front page, they're featuring our Alice Waters Evolutionaries. Kind of Alice's life story is on the front page of the iTunes podcast store.
Oh, nice. Now,
so that's fun.
Let me ask you a question. Do we sell anything other than us?
Nope.
Oh, all right.
That's why you should donate.
Yes. All right. Well, that's good news. I'm going to go check that out. And did you already tell these guys like little blurb on what they're going to get out of the new website, what it's going to do that they couldn't get before from the Heritage Radio Network?
The new website features an entire kind of new department of in-house produced content. So we've got six sort of categories: pleasure, health, news, opinion, business, science, and technology. And we're both from the programs weekly, and then just from scratch in the office putting together in-house content. So kind of transitioning to more news, more reporting, stuff like that. It's really good stuff.
Nice. All right then. Well, let's take some questions. Call in your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. And just so you guys know, I can't personally check my tweets during the show because I'm talking during the show. So if you have questions you want to tweet in, if you don't want to call in, tweet it to @HeritageRadioNetwork. Is that right, Jack?
It's @Heritage_Radio.
Shows what the hell I know.
Yeah.
You know what?
Close.
How is it that I know nothing? How long did it take me, Jack, to memorize our telephone number?
Yeah, it's still a process.
It took like a year and a half for me to memorize our telephone number. Well, whatever. So, Devin Stone tweeted in, at Cooking Issues, Trader Joe's sells most of their protein in vacuum bags, some clear, some black. Are they low temperature safe? Devin, I wasn't able to find anything off the bat on the composition of the Trader Joe's bags, and I dreaded, but I will do during the next week, fighting my way up the corporate ladder to find a human being who knows what the hell's going on. But everyone knows what a pain in the butt it is to deal with corporations like that, right, Stas?
Yep.
But I will tell you something about Trader Joe's. You know, Stas, what are your feelings on Trader Joe's?
They're okay.
Well, what do you really think?
I don't like their Hawaiian shirts.
You don't like their Hawaiian shirts? Yeah. Well, you know, I always kind of like, I was fine with Trader Joe's. I had no problem with Trader Joe's. Until I found this out. You ready for this? Are you familiar with the Bread and Life? Bread and Life is like, they provide food for people that don't have it, and they take donations. They're in Brooklyn, actually.
Yeah.
You know Bread and
Life. Good friends of the station.
Yeah, good friends of the station. Well, Jack, you might be interested to know this, and I'm not telling anyone to change their buying behavior based on this, but a lot of the big food purveyors around, like Whole Foods and whatnot, right, they will give their, like the day before their stuff is going to expire, they'll take it off the shelves and they'll give it to organizations like Bread and Life, who will instantly cook with it so that they can get it out before the expiry date, right, and then they're not throwing away or wasting all this food, right? That makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, Trader Joe's doesn't. Because they think it's too much of a hassle. They specifically destroy the food, throw it out in dumpsters, instead of giving it to Bread and Life because they think it's going to be too much of a hassle.
That's
so that I know,
terrible.
Yeah, so I know some of the higher-ups at Bread and Life have stopped buying at Trader Joe's. And, my wife encourages me to stop buying at Trader Joe's. I haven't done enough research yet, but, I mean, I'm hoping this is just – that's just like some sort of like corporate like brain – whatever you want to call it – on the air – and that they maybe could change their policies. But if anyone who's listening knows anyone at Trader Joe's and wants to, I don't know, comment on that or have maybe figure out a way to change their policies, because literally the Bread and Life people were told, it's just too much of a headache for us to give all this free food that we're going to throw away to all the people who need it.
It's terrible.
That sucks, right, Jack? Mm-hmm.
See, now with our in-house kind of production, I'm thinking we're going to have to call Trader Joe's and get a comment, follow up on this.
Yeah, because that's crap, right?
We'll report back to you. That is crap.
That's crap. That is what we here at the Heritage Radio Network like to refer to as a load of crap.
We have a caller on the line.
Oh, okay. Caller, you're on the air.
Hey, this is John Doe.
Hey, how you doing? I was going to call out one of your tweets there that you let me find it here. There it is. Finally made fish sauce cured bacon. Freaking delicious. I saw the picture. So tell us about it.
So basically, Piper gave me the base brine, and I just replaced the salt with fish sauce. And it was actually around 8%. So then I just boosted it a bit to get to the 12.5%. And then just added brown sugar and water to the appropriate percentages to get the brine. Then I left it in the fridge probably a little bit longer than I should have. So it was slightly oversalted, but I compensated by doing just like a couple stages of dilution and just water. That's actually one of the questions I've been calling you about. But
sure.
So then, tried it for a few days to build the pellicle, and then just smoked it for a couple hours with mesquite, and it came out really awesome. But the funny story is, when I had first cured it, when I had discovered that it was way too salty, I pretty much stunk out the whole house. People were pretty upset with me, but that was funny. It was still very good, but it was just really powerful and somewhat inconsumable, but I mean, you could put in stuff, but then I just did the dilution and that ended up working out. So actually my question is there some way to come up with like a concentration such that you take care of, you know, the botulism, all the bad things that come along with it without having to figure out the exact time, like basically leave it in there indefinitely. Without having to worry too much about, you know, being under or over salted, is there some sort of cross, basically a crossing between optimal flavor and handling all the microbes that you don't want in there?
Well, sure. I mean, the things like botulism you're going to take care of with nitrites. Did you add nitrites to it?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. Okay. So I mean, like, and the nitrite concentrations are small enough. You know, you don't have to use. Were you using a Prague powder, or were you using like a salt with nitrites in it?
I was using what's referred to as pink salt. So yeah. I think it was salt with nitrates in it.
Yeah. So in other words, you don't need to add enough. Like that stuff's not going to radically increase the saltiness of your product because you're not going to be adding that much relative to the quantity of what would normally be regular white salt to it, right?
Okay.
So it's the pink salt that's going to take care of the beasties that you're really worried about, like the ones that will grow perhaps if you were going to cold smoke or hold it, right? So that's going to take care of that stuff. And you said you added extra salt to the fish sauce, right?
Yeah, it was 8%, so I brought it up to 12.5%, which is, I believe, to be the basic brine for a bacon.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can do various different brine concentrations. I'd have to look up exactly kind of what the minimums are, but you're not holding it for a long time. You know what I mean?
Right.
So if the nitrite levels are high enough to inhibit things like botulism and to get a good pink cure, which I saw the picture, sucker's pink, right?
So
I mean, like, that's going to take care of a lot of those problems. Another thing, you're saying that it was unbearable, the salt or the aroma. Did you try pre-cooking the fish sauce a little bit to blast off some of the volatiles?
What I had done was I took it. You know, once it came out of the brine, I just took it out immediately to cook it just to taste how much salt penetration was in it. So I think I had some excess. It was still pretty wet.
Right.
So that's why a lot of, you know, it was pretty stinky. So.
No, I mean, did you cook the, did you, like, boil the fish sauce a little bit before you used it as a brine?
Oh, no, I didn't. I just did it straight.
Right. That might mellow it a little bit in terms of how it smells after it comes out. I have never done any side-by-sides, but it's always been my mental perception that heated fish sauce tastes very different or smells very different from unheated fish sauce. But that could just be because once it fills up the kitchen and it's combining with the ingredients, that it just smells totally different once it's combined. I don't know. But, you know, it's always been my feeling that, like, something's volatilizing off of the fish sauce that kind of rounds it out and makes it less offensive to the people around who might not love fish sauce as much as we do.
You know. That's a fair point. Yeah. I will consider that.
Yeah, I mean, it might be hard to love fish sauce as much as I do. I mean, you know, and be, you know, from the East Coast of America, because that stuff is just straight up delicious. What brand of fish sauce did you use?
I forget what brand it was, but I found a brand that didn't have any of the fake hydrogenated vegetable proteins.
Yeah,
I can follow you. I can shoot you a picture of it. I forget exactly which brand it was. I think it was the one with the baby on the front.
Oh yeah, I forget the name of that one. I did once, years ago, like 4 years ago or something. I did a side by side of a lot of the ones that were available in kind of the local markets around Lower Manhattan where I live. And I mean, as anyone who knows, listen to me. There's a lot of Japanese fish sauce out there that I love. And there's one that's not really available here that's made with ishiri, and there's a bunch of different ishiris.
Nice.
And one of them is called one of them's from squid, solely from squid guts. And that sucker is amazing because it's extremely meaty. And that's the one that I think tastes as close to Sally Granger, who's the she's the fish, the garum, the Roman fish sauce expert, and she's done a lot of recreations of recipes in large tanks as part of her PhD thesis on fish sauce. And she's done a lot of work with Apicius, and she and her husband did a translation slash adaptation of Apicius for, maybe 7-8 years ago. That is, I think, the best one that's available in terms of historical accuracy of cooking, because it starts from the premise that they actually meant what they said when they were writing, as opposed to some of the earlier, like the Dover publication, who's the translator on that, just, you know, kind of plays fast and loose with it, assuming that we moderns know better about cooking than they did back then, when it's always better to assume that someone who's writing about something is writing about it, you know. So I tasted her fish sauce a number of years ago that was the garum sociarum, which was made from mackerel guts in her case and aged for, I think, 2 or 3 years. And that was very close to this one Japanese ishiri. And the difference between it and normal fish sauce is it had much more of a kind of canned meat, hammy, bacony flavor than your standard fish sauces. But of the standard fish sauces, I mean, the ones that a lot of people like, like, for instance, like the three crabs or whatever it is like super doped with isolates, protein isolates. The one that my favorite is Tiparos, which isn't the one with the baby on the front, but that of the commercially easy ones to get, I like that one. I believe Tiparos is out of Thailand, but I'm not sure. I never know. Everyone from from that area of the world argues about who's got the best fish sauce, you know. But what are you gonna do? I can look it up, but I wouldn't worry about it being unsafe with having just the 8% on a brine like that. And then you'll get, you know, relatively more fish sauce flavor versus salt flavor, which might be good. And I would just do a side by side where you just boil a small sample of fish sauce and then taste it versus the raw, just side by side after they cool, to see what happens.
Okay. Just one more quick question on the, you know how I did that ice cream cone with the microwave cake?
Yes, also on my tweet, in case you guys ever follow my tweets. Yep.
So the one question I had was, we were trying to just draw patterns on a plate or be able to build, you know, little structures to be able to put other dessert things next to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if some sort of hydrocolloid or some sort of thickener that could add to it that would still allow the pulsing effect of microwaving, but hold more structure.
Is there a lot of dairy in the cake?
No, it's actually just, I think it ends up being half a stick of butter, 4 tablespoons of butter.
Right.
It's mostly egg and then egg white powder.
Right. If you prehydrate methylcellulose from the either A or SG series, a fairly viscous one, if you prehydrate that in water to a fairly high degree, so it's kind of pasty, and then fold that into the mix, that will gelatinize after. So what you need to pre-foam that, right? So you pre-foam that, and then if you have egg white or xanthan or something in there that's holding the structure See, the issue with these things is that with cakes, there is you need to have structure beforehand, right? And that's what holds the bubbles as they grow. And then you need to have structure. You need to have structure afterwards, which is the starch that sets. So, you know, years and years ago, I was working with Johnny Azzini, and one of the things we did for a demonstration we were working on was a no protein, you know, cake. Like angel food cake style, but without that kind of bite of egg protein. And we worked it out with methylcellulose, and we would foam with an ISI canister, EC canister, into molds. We would foam a cake batter mix that had, as a portion of it, hydrated methylcellulose. The issue, and it worked, because the methylcellulose, it was already foamed. The methylcellulose would gel as it heated. It gelled. It held the structure in the same way that a protein will hold the structure in a cake. And then after it was cooked, the starch took over. Problem is that it has bad interactions with dairy. You know, like methylcellulose doesn't necessarily react well or work well in high dairy applications.
Okay. I'll give it a go and let you know how it works out.
Cool. Thanks a lot.
And then we got.
Thanks so much.
All right. Talk to you soon.
We got a tweet. Pink salt for bacon.
Yeah, you don't use pink salt for bacon? That was a question mark.
That was a question mark. Yeah.
Yeah. No. I mean, is someone like you, like I? Okay. Look, if you go to what's it called? If you know pink salt, by the way, for those who don't know, is what they do is they mix. There's two different kinds of pink salt. Ones that have nitrites in them, which are the ones that we normally use, and ones that have nitrates. You only want to use nitrates for long cured things like country hams and whatnot, because nitrates break down over time into nitrites. And so, in a short cured thing like bacon, you're only supposed to use nitrites. And nitrites. I mean, look, this is all on top of my head, so it could be that, like, a huge portion of my brain was erased somehow and that, like, my data is totally wrong, which say someone please tweet and tell me. But, you know, when people, like, for instance, let's say you go to Whole Foods and you buy what's called uncured bacon, they should put giant quotes around that, because what happens is they use foodstuffs like celery that are very, very high in nitrites, and then they just purify, I guess remove the flavor, and, greatly purify concentrate the amount of nitrites, you know, that are in the celery itself, right, such that that is strong enough to cure the bacon. Bacon that is actually uncured looks like roast pork, right, and tastes like salted roast pork, which is not bad. Ain't bacon, you know what I mean? And I'm pretty sure that they add the pink color to the salts just so that you don't accidentally use it as salt. And I'm virtually certain, I would say 99.99% certain that, and I always forget, they're called Prague powders or Instacure powders. I never remember whether it's number one or number two. I just can't remember because I choose not to. They color it pink. Now, if you get nitrites in the form of Tenderquick, Morton's Tenderquick, that is NaCl, regular salt, mixed with sodium nitrite in a dosage that's meant to be used straight, and that sucker is not pink. So if you're using Tenderquick or what's called, you know, that kind of a curing salt on a bacon, then which is, you know, it can be recommended because there's no possibility really of error with it. But anyway, so someone tweet on in and tell me that, you know, my brain was erased, because there's always a good chance. All righty. Should we take a break?
No, keep
going?
More, yeah.
All right, Stas says keep going, so I'll keep going. Christian Spinello at Eat the Pig tweeted in, listened to a back show where you talked about octopus and was curious if there is an anesthesia step. Anesthesia step. Why is that so hard? Is that a tongue? You try it.
That's a good anesthesia step.
Yeah, Stas is good at that stuff because, yeah, anyway. Or Ikejime step for them. Piper, by the way, get Piper drunk. No. Not difficult. says that tongue twisters are, like, he hates tongue twisters. He won't say it.
Are the poor man's pun.
But that, to me, they're unrelated.
Yeah.
Like, the tongue twister is unrelated to a pun. Who the hell knows what he was talking about, right?
Yeah, he was in the car, so he wasn't drunk. Well.
Yeah, well, who knows. Love you, Piper. I'm sure he's listening, and now I'm going to have to put up with that all day. He never listens, except for today he's going to listen just so that he can hear that and then give me crap
salt,
for being the bad person that I am, right?
Give you pink salt. Actually.
Give you... Ooh. Ooh.
Wow.
Okay. So that is a very interesting question, Christian, and one that I can't believe that we haven't thought about before, and part of the issue is... that I've never purchased a live octopus at a market. Have either of you guys ever had that live tiny octopus on a chopstick? It's not really, I don't really want, it's not that I wouldn't eat it if someone handed it to me. It's just not in my thing. You know what I mean? But the reason why it's super interesting is that, you know, as I've said, you know, many times, cephalopods, you know, octopus and some squid in particular, but really octopus, are kind of the geniuses of the invertebrate world. They're extremely smart, but they're very bizarre in that their brains don't function the same way ours do. They're not put together the same way. Now, their the neuron transmission works the same way because, you know, nerves had already developed by that time, and so they function in similar pathways, but their nervous system and their way of cognition, however you want to put it, right? And I think that we're all past this idea that animals are somehow just machines that can be have no sort of inner life or workings at all. I think we're kind of past that as a society, don't you think, Stas? Mm-hmm. I mean, very few people think that anymore. I think, you know, there's a bunch of hardcore scientists who kind of believe that, but it's almost the equivalent of solipsism on an individual basis to believe that we are the only animals that have some sort of inner life. It just doesn't really make any sense. But, you know, the question is, you know, does a clam really think about a lot? Is there an inner life to a clam? I don't think so. But the closely related octopus, I mean, it can do some pretty complicated and amazing things and can learn some pretty complicated and amazing things. So I think it would be a little disingenuous to think that an octopus doesn't have some sort of inner life going on, whether or not they're aware of their own existence or not, whether, you know, that's unclear. But it is very interesting to think about what anesthesia and particular what ikijime might do to them. Now, ikijime is a set of Japanese fish-killing techniques. But in the larger sense, you know, we're not referring to any particular traditional or even newer Japanese killing technique when we're talking about this subject. We're talking about the purposeful, quick killing of an animal, in this case fish, because ikijime means, you know, fish killing, in a way that increases their quality. And typically, when you think about fish, and I don't want to get stuck into arguments of, you know, what is the fish actually feeling? The question is do things that seem like less stressful ways of killing the animal, right, from an anthropomorphic thing, let's not even talk about being rigorous, do things that seem like they would make sense to reduce the stress of slaughter, like anesthesia, like taking the brain out right away, muscle stress in this sense, like destroying the spinal cord so that there's no more impulses coming from the spinal cord to the muscles to use up the ATP to cause rigor, which is why you want to destroy the spinal cord in some strong swimming fish like bass and tuna. So the question is things like that that make sense from a human perspective as reducing stress, do they have an effect in the taste? Now, you don't even have to think about what's going on in the inner mind of the fish because you have a much more verifiable result. Things that look like they cause less stress cause the animal to taste better when you eat it. So there is an effect. So it's like humane, whatever that means, killing techniques somehow align in this case, and hopefully in as many cases as we can see, align with best practices from a food preparation standpoint. Now, in an octopus, I came across a site, I'm looking for it here, www.nichirefresh.co.jp. And they do octopus, and they say some interesting stuff. They say their octopi, but they say octopuses when they translate it, are caught one at a time using pot traps. It's said that only strong, healthy octopuses enter the pot traps while the shallow waters are still abundantly full with prey. This enables us to capture strong, firm-limbed octopuses of the highest quality. Unlike the trawling method, this harvest method does not disturb the harvesting waters, and it also prevents over-harvesting, making it much better for the environment and for resource conservation. That's really interesting, just on that standpoint, because the idea that you want to catch a good, strong octopus, and those are the ones that go into pot traps, it kind of makes sense because, you know, they like to hide, right? So, I mean, I don't really know what an octopus pot trap looks like, but they might go in there thinking they're hiding, and they get trapped, right? Whereas it's a well-known fact that as soon as a male octopus donates its sperm, or whatever you want to call it, to the female octopus, that it goes, like, it's called senility, it goes insane, senescence, it goes crazy and just starts wandering around on the bottom of the ocean floor so that it can get picked apart by whatever prey you want. So then you're getting kind of crappy, yeah. Or, and on the flip side, as soon as the female lays its eggs, it stops eating and sits in the cave, like blowing water over the eggs to keep things from growing on it and guarding them against predators. And then as soon as the babies hatch, she wanders out to get picked apart, eaten, and died in senescence. So, yeah, so you want a nice, good-tasting octopus that hasn't gone into senescence already. You got to get one that still has its self-preservation instincts intact. Stas is looking something up she can talk about in a minute because I don't have time to look at the picture right now. But she's going to – what do you got a picture
it's
of there,
Stas? It's a picture of a Japanese octopus pot trap.
Yeah?
With a calm, happy octopus.
And it does look a lot like a cave that an octopus might go in. It makes sense. Yeah. And it literally says, calm, happy octopus. And the name of the trap is Tako Isubo.
Yeah.
Tako Isubo. Anyway, so I thought that was really interesting. And then here's the other thing that they say is they say then that they practice Ikijime on it to kill it very quickly. Now, there's an article that's available in the September – it's available September 2013 in the Journal of Experimental Marine Biology and Ecology called The Identification and Management of Pain, Suffering, and Distress in Cephalopods, Including Anesthesia, Analgesia, and Humane Killing, and it's by Paul Andrews et al., and yes, so it's a fairly recent article, and it's extremely interesting. So they, for those of you that are interested, and it is an interesting subject, and we don't have time to go into it now, but they go over all of the markers that human beings would look in a supposedly non-anthropomorphic way, although it doesn't make sense to think of it really in a non-anthropomorphic way, of how you would judge whether or not something is experiencing pain to the degree that that animal should be protected in a research environment. And then it goes on to figure out whether or not we can prevent those sorts of pain. And pain, remember, is different from nociception. This is getting complicated for a radio show, but nociception is the idea that there is a noxious stimulus and animals go away from it. So you take a cockroach and you put fire next to the cockroach. Cockroach moves away from the fire. Are they experiencing pain? I don't know. Or are they just responding to the heat in the way that a sensor, a smoke detector sensor responds to smoke, right? So a response to what human would consider a noxious stimulus is nociception. Pain is a consciousness state that has to do with whether or not the animal understands that something is going on and feels some sort of distress relative to that. So they go through a bunch of arguments about what that would mean, and then they go into what is now the important part for us, which is, what regulates that? So the two main two of the anesthetics that they use, one of which is clove oil, which is the one that we use when we're anesthetizing fish, and there's a lot of data on using clove oil and its derivatives, eugenol and isoeugenol, to anesthetize fish, right? And I've done it many times. I've anesthetized lobsters, which are an entirely different set of, animals, crustacean, with eugenol, and I believe that there is an observable difference, and therefore I don't have to worry about whether or not we're actually what's going on in the mind of a lobster, because I feel that they taste different if they're anesthetized beforehand and if they're killed quickly. So the question is, does it work in cephalopods? Answer, yes, it appears to work in cephalopods. But here's the interesting part. Magnesium chloride, which is a widely available salt, you can get it at the Duane Reade. Remember we got the magnesium chloride at the Duane Reade? Magnesium chloride added to the water that invertebrates like mollusks and clams are living in causes them to lose their muscle. It's a muscle relaxant, right? And so if you add the right amount of magnesium chloride to the solution, and here I have the numbers, it's approximately 0.5% weight magnesium chloride in volume, along with 1% ethanol, it will cause their muscles to completely relax. Now, what you don't know here, right, what you can't know, is whether or not that is actually shutting their brain down or whether it's just shutting down the ability of their muscles to work. But large amounts of magnesium chloride stop respiration and cause the animal to die. So a humane killing technique, Ikijime style, might be to put a small amount of clove oil along with a small amount of ethanol and magnesium chloride to slow their muscles down and to put them into a state of anesthesia, right? And then to add more magnesium chloride to stop their respiration and then, do whatever, cut your brain out. The other, here's the issue problem with octopi is that they don't have a central brain. They have a large kind of brain near the eye, so there's midline dissection where you take out the entire eye area and get rid of the brain section. But they have a bunch of other, quote-unquote, brain sections, unlike us, right? But that's one of the humane, or complete decapitation of the octopus, immediate decapitation of the octopus, another good Ikijime extreme anyway. But
are the brains in other parts of the body, or it's all the head?
No, I think it's like a separate. And like most of the neurons in an octopus are in their tentacles. Not most, but I haven't done the research in a long time. But a huge amount of the neurons in the octopus are in the tentacles, because like the, for instance. It's very complicated, but the point is that nobody really understands what it means to knock out the consciousness of an octopus, because nobody understands what octopus consciousness is. And one of the fascinating things about researching cephalopods is that their entire method of perception of the world is different than ours. So that, like, proprioception, like how you know where your body is in space, works entirely differently in cephalopods than it does in mammals. And so it's kind of hard to evaluate what's going on. But it's an extremely interesting subject, and anyone out there who has access to live octopi, I'd be curious to run some tests on taste. You know what I'm saying? Because that's the only thing I know I can test, is how that sucker tastes on my – how that smart, awesome thing tastes once it gets in my mouth. Anyway.
Wait, let's take a break.
Oh, we'll take a break. Come back with Cooking Issues.
Every August for the past 10 years, Heritage Foods USA has had the great honor of announcing the arrival of a new generation of Good Shepherd Ranch Heritage Turkeys and a new chapter in the history of an endangered species. You have to eat them to save them. While many farmers now use the term, Frank Reese and his team raised the truest example of the original Heritage Turkey. According to the USDA, they remain the only farm allowed to use the name Heritage on their label. We hope you reserve your healthy, naturally mating, flying, standard bronze, bourbon red, white Holland, slate, black, or Narragansett turkey today. Let's do it again and support the brightest hope for the turkey. We guarantee these are the best tasting turkeys ever, or your money back. Prices start at $75. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
And welcome back to Cooking Issues. We've had some of those Heritage turkeys. They were straight up delicious. I think I did a bionic turkey on a Heritage thing once. That was, I think, maybe the best one we ever did. We did a bionic Heritage turkey.
Yeah.
And sucker was awesome. You know, the bionic turkey is where we rip out the skeleton, replace it with a skeleton, an aluminum tube skeleton with holes cut in it so that we can pump heated oil through, cook it from the inside out so that it cooks quickly, and then flash fry it afterwards to get a crispy skin, which is delicious. Should we do that again? If we tell Patrick that we're going to do some sort of fancy thing, you think he'll hook us up? Yeah. Hook us up with a Heritage turkey?
We'd probably make that happen.
Sweet.
We had a question come in too about alternate proteins, like in the form of bugs, and if you think bugs will find their way on menus soon.
Well, I mean, bugs have found their way on menus, you know, already. I mean, you know, in Mexico, you got those fried grasshoppers, which I just don't think taste good. That's the thing. I mean, they're crunchy, but a lot of things are crunchy. You know what I'm saying? You've had those, right, Stas?
I don't think so.
And I don't like them. And then there's the ant eggs, you know, escamole, which I haven't had, but I think those are extremely, you know, high priced. There's witchetty grubs. You know, some grubs are apparently delicious tasting. I mean, there's no reason not to eat them, you know, other than the gross factor, and that they're fairly small, right? So I don't know. I don't think there's any reason why they shouldn't. I mean, like, obviously there's a grossness factor that a lot of people have to get over. But, you know, then – you know who is big into eating bugs is Dana Goodyear. Didn't she write about that in her new Eating Bugs? And then the Natural History Museum had that big bug-eating thing a couple of years back.
I don't remember.
You know who else? I bet you Paul Adams from Popular Science has eaten himself a lot of bugs. I bet you that guy's eating himself a lot of bugs. We had this in on the Twitter. Dan D. at Eat the Fat. At Cooking Issues, Trader Joe's in STL, which is St. Louis, we think, donates, right?
Yeah.
St. Louis. Donates a lot of food to our local at-campus kitchens. Maybe it's just a in-store decision. Well, it's good to know that it's not Trader Joe's nationwide, and it just means, hey, New York Trader Joe's, step on up and give some food to Bread and Life. What?
There's a lot of Trader Joe's here. I think there's three now.
Yeah, but I'm sure they're probably all run. Hey, Jack, you want to say something nice about the Bread and Life, friends of our station, all the good work they do?
Well, yeah, they work with Heritage Foods also. We give them a lot of hams, I believe, and then come Thanksgiving, we work with them as well. They were one of the sponsors of the Bushwick Block Party, so they're like always around here.
Also,
Anthony Butler is a great guy. I don't know if you met him.
Yeah, no, yeah, I have. I know some, you know, my wife's done some architecture work for them, and so has, you know, another couple of friends of mine. They just happen to be really kind of good people, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, Trader Joe's, just, you know, give them the stuff that you're about to throw away. Why throw it away? Why have it go to waste? There's plenty of people here in New York that could use the food. Am I right, Jack?
Absolutely.
Okay. Here's a question out to you guys. Tom Fisher, you asked us about the eggnog. Did it work? Did it thicken? It's been like a week or two, right, since we answered that question? The eggnog should be thick now. Let us know. Tweet on in.
We need to do our own eggnog soon.
Oh, dang, yeah. Well, before Thanksgiving, we have to set our eggnog. Piper's going to do something crazy with it, though, right? He can't help it.
No, let's do it correctly.
You and I are going to do it? We won't tell him until afterwards?
Or you can do his own. You can do it side by side.
Oh, jeez. He does love the side-by-side. Another follow-up. Drew Bushorn wrote in on Tempe. He had tweeted in and asked us about whether or not you could use microbial transglutaminase, which, by the way, transglutaminase is what we call meat glue, and it's the enzyme that bonds proteins together. It binds a glutamine residue, which is an amino acid, to a lysine residue in a COVID. It's such a gross word. Why would I say residue when I'm talking about food? Residue. Lysine residue. Anyway, so it bonds these things together, and it comes from microbes. It's called microbial transglutaminase, and it usually has various helper proteins. The question is, could you glue Tempe together with it? And apparently the answer, and you can see it because he responded to the Twitter, is yes, it does. It glues it together, and he says, what did he say here? Thanks for putting together a good program. Long live the hammer. Fan of the hammer. There's got to be one fan of the hammer. Oh,
I have a couple.
I know you do. Oh, come on, please. Everyone loves the hammer. Come on, please. A few days back, I tweeted Dave about using his favorite enzyme, transglutaminase, to make steamed tempeh solid enough to char burger style. Since I know he's not a big veggie, but he might be amused by the results, I thought I'd report back. The upper half, he shows the part that's not TG'd, and it's just all broken apart. And the bottom patty with a 1% by mass transglutaminase, which is a good number for something like that. And it tasted pretty – it worked well and tasted pretty good with lettuce and mayo. Well, everything tastes good with lettuce and mayo, right? I mean, lettuce and mayo tastes good. Man, add a good tomato, and you're almost all the way to a bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich. Yeah. And in fact, even if you're a vegetarian, I hate to say this, because bacon, lettuce, tomato. And we're talking with Mark Ladner about this over the weekend, because we did an event at the Discovery Center at the Thanksgiving Farm, which we could talk about later. Discovery Center, something else. That's like a science museum or something. Center for Discovery. You know me. Anyway, so the point is that, like, that's kind of one of the great sandwiches. Mark thinks that the reason it's such a great sandwich is you can have it at any time of day. I'm going to get a lot of flack about this, but it's not as good a sandwich, but almost as good a sandwich as just the toasted, crappy white bread, mayo, an excellent tomato and lettuce.
Yeah.
I mean, right?
Subbing bacon for the mayo, is that what you're saying?
No,
you need mayo no matter what, Jack. Don't try to make a BLT without mayo. Here. Jeez, do you eat BLTs without mayo, Jack?
No.
Is this a problem we're going to have?
No.
All right. I was about to go up. You can feel me spooling into...
Yeah, headphones would have been down.
The headphones, like, you know, like the gloves come off in the hockey. Boom! On the ice. Anyway, okay. So that was it. Just a good follow-up. Thanks. And we like to hear follow-ups like that, right? We enjoy that stuff. Okay, we had a question in last week, but we forget who it came in from, right? I think it was a caller about gluten-free ramen. And they wanted to know whether or not you could add kanswe, which is the kind of alkaline salts that are used to firm up alkaline noodles, of which ramen is one of those. So you add to flour, you add kanswe. It raises the pH, makes it more alkaline. And raising the pH strengthens the gluten in it and causes the noodles to have more bite, more snap, more elasticity. It makes them firmer, right? Which is one of the reasons why people do alkaline noodles. The other one is there's a specific alkaline taste that you like if you're accustomed to that. And we're accustomed to that in certain things. It's a slightly different alkaline taste, but for instance, in pretzels have an alkaline taste to them because they're boiled in alkaline water before they're or dipped in alkaline bath before they're baked, which is why they have that awesome color and that specific pretzel taste. Back to this. So the other thing that the alkaline stuff does in wheat flour is it turns it yellow, which is why you have those kind of bright yellow alkaline noodles, right? Now, with ramen, I think most of the time ramen is made in an alkaline noodle, semi-alkaline noodle process, not a high level of alkaline noodles from the data that I could get from, you know, the internets on the actual industrial production of ramen. So, but the classic ramen production is you make the noodle, probably with alkaline, out of wheat flour, sometimes with the addition of potato starch or other very fast hydrating starches to allow the rehydration to take place much faster in the cup when you add the boiling water to it when you're making the ramen. I haven't made ramen in so many years from the bags. Have you ever? When was the last time you had one of those things?
3 years ago. Yeah, but, you mean like that?
Yeah, like the one that you actually buy the package, you break it open with the little flavor pack.
Oh, yeah, no. 20 yeah. years.
20? Dang. I used to eat the hell out of those. Those are good and cheap. Anyway, so what happens is you make the noodles. They are steam. Oh, this is kind of cool. They have a conveyor belt, and the conveyor belt runs at two different speeds, right? So a faster running conveyor belt loads onto a slower running conveyor belt, and that's how they get the wave in it. Yeah, by a differential conveyor belt. It's fed onto, and then they get the wave in it. When it's on, after it goes on the slower conveyor belt that causes the wave, it goes through a steam tunnel. The steam tunnel cooks the starch out, right? It then goes, it's then cut, sometimes folded. Then they put it on another conveyor belt that stretches it out a little bit to separate the noodles after they've done that. This is all pretty cool, right? And then that's after the steam thing. And then it gets cut and sometimes folded into the full block if you're going to put it into a block form for like in packaging and plastic. Then goes into a fryer. It fries to dehydrate it. It's a fast dehydration step. It also, as opposed to regular dehydration, opens the pores in the noodles because it's boiling the water out. And that's why ramen rehydrates so quickly, because it's got all these open pore structures from the frying. And that's also why you can eat ramen without cooking it, and it's got kind of a good crunchy texture because it's more porous than dried pasta. That's why it tastes better raw-ish than pasta. It's then further dehydrated a little more and packaged. That's how the ramen works. So then the question is, so clearly adding kanzue to gluten-free ramen isn't going to add the functional benefits of texture that you would get in wheat flour. However, there is a new article out. I think it's brand new. I think it's like not even out until 2014. I think it's one of those ones that's in pre-press right now in the journal Food Chemistry called Quality Improvement of Rice Noodle Restructured with Rice Protein Isolate and Transglutaminase by Yang Kim et al. And it's specifically looking at increasing the toothiness of rice noodles using transglutaminase. And they talk specifically, I think, about ramen and how ramen might work. Okay. What's interesting, if you look this paper up, is they have photos of scanning electron microscopy photos of just plain rice looks like as a noodle. And like everyone knows has ever just made a rice noodle, it's like a bunch of BBs. It doesn't hold together well. There's no structure. There's no protein network like there would be in something that has gluten, which is why when you're making gluten-free things with rice, what you do is you cook off some of the rice first and then add that cooked rice back to your raw rice flour, because otherwise it has no structure, right? So they have that. Then they have that just with transglutaminase added, and it doesn't do that much joining back together because rice is fairly low in proteins that can be bound together by transglutaminase. What they did, and then they said that, look, one way to get around this is to add soy proteins and all these other things, but these guys did a study where they added rice protein back to it and transglutaminase, and you can see it. And the one on the one that it has the added rice protein added back to it, as well as transglutaminase added to bind it together, looks a lot more like a traditional dough structure than that. So maybe that's a way to increase in a gluten-free application the toothsomeness of it. And you could probably also, if you can't get rice protein, you could probably do a little bit of cooked rice, soy protein, unless you're against it, that's hydrated along with the rice with transglutaminase and get more of a firm kind of snappy texture out of it. But go take a look at that article. Because, it seems fairly interesting. The only issue I have is that, as I've said, there were arguments, and I haven't had the time to do the research to really suss it out, about whether or not adding transglutaminase to things that contain trace amounts of gluten, whether it makes the gluten fraction more reactive or less reactive for people who suffer from celiac. And I've heard kind of arguments on both sides. However, I will say that this article is specifically addressing the issue of celiac. And so, they're looking to make a gluten-free, rice-only product that has good eating qualities, and they are interested in the ramen issue. So it's something to look at, and, it's current right now. That's two transglutaminase questions.
I'm going to send it to Mark.
Yeah? All right, cool. Oh, yeah, right. Next, we have in from, you think it's pronounced Philippe? I think so, Philippe. Philippe Lament. It's kind of awesome to have a last name, Lament.
I think it's a good name altogether.
Philippe Lament. Yeah. I bet you super happy though. If you have a name like Lament, you can't be melancholy. No. You know what I mean? Because, you know, well, at least if it was Piper, he's like, I'm not living up to my name. I won't. Anyway. Hello, Nastasha, Dave, Jack, and Joe. It's Philippe Lament writing. Love your show. I have a question about soft serve ice cream. Some of my good friends acquired a soft serve machine amazingly, and I told them I'd be glad to make a ton of ice cream base for them for a party. Now, I know how to make ice cream that is churned regularly, but soft serve is different, more overrun, right? What do I do to make a baller soft serve base? Okay, this is a great question. Here's the deal. So I once was the proud owner of a soft serve ice cream machine. Also, kind of strangely, I was walking down the street one day. This is, you know, I don't know, 15 years ago. I was walking down the street in the garment district where I used to live. And just literally someone had thrown out on the side of the street a giant, like, you know, two flavors and a twist Taylor soft serve ice cream machine on wheels. And I was like, look, someone threw out an ice cream machine. And my wife's like, so what? I'm like, so what? It's coming back to our house. And it weighs like, because, you know, yeah, whatever. So, but the sucker weighs 900 pounds and it's on these crappy little casters. I know it weighs 900 pounds because I looked up the cut sheet later on the sucker. And so anyway, it was on this, you know, those crappy little casters that machines are on that aren't really meant to. And if any of you have been to the garment district, the only roads that are worse are the ones in lower Manhattan down where we are now. But like the garment district has these like all bent, all the roads are messed up from heavy trucks years just rolling over them all the time, right? So I'm rolling this thing back a couple blocks to my, you know, my loft where I lived at the time, and we roll it in, and, you know, I spend the next day and a half blowing all the roaches out of it and, like, you know, completely nuking it such that there was nothing left alive in it, you know, making sure that I wasn't bringing a family of rats with me or anything like this. Disassemble the machine, put it back together. Unfortunately, one of the compressors was shot. In fact, two of the compressors were shot. So instead of two flavors and a twist, I had kind of one flavor where the cylinder compressor worked. And the actual refrigeration compressor thing that keeps the base going didn't work at all. So I had to like pack that with ice to get it to work. And this was the first time I'd ever made a huge quantity of ice cream base. And so what I'll say is this. When you're making – then this applies to anything. If you have low temperature, you're going to want to go ahead and – because you're going to make gallons. If you have a nice soft serve ice cream machine, like I remember I was like, crap, I can't even fire this sucker up reasonably unless I'm making like 4 gallons. So I tried to make a 4-gallon or 5-gallon batch of ice cream base in my turkey frying pot, right? Now, if you've never done this before, it is very difficult to get an even temperature. And stupidly, because I'm a jerk, I tried to make the whole batch at once just by whisking really hard. And the bottom of it, obviously, I got a little overheated. I didn't move it fast. And so all of a sudden, I see bloop. I see all of these. I see the coagulated, overcooked egg float to the top. I'm like, no. So I tried filtering it out, right? Also, if you've met me, you know that I was very late and like I needed the ice cream on the table, right? Because it was family dinner. I needed to have this stuff out. You know, Stiles is shaking her head because she knows how I am. So I was like, oh no. I didn't have the time to cool it down just by putting it in the case. So first of all, I filtered it out. Sucker tastes like scrambled eggs. This is way prior to Heston Blumenthal making scrambled egg ice cream famous. I could have been like, well, I'm just doing Heston Blumenthal's recipe. I'm just trying out this. Yeah, but I mean, what do you mean? I meant to do this. This is what Heston does all the time. You know, listen, if you're not looking for scrambled egg ice cream, no good. And I haven't had Heston's. I'm sure it's delicious. I don't want to talk about that. So anyway, I needed to cool this base down super quick, right, that I had made, and I had messed up part of it by curdling part of it. It was at the last minute, too. It's always at the last minute that you ruin the base, which is why it's so horrible. I thankfully hadn't burnt it because that would be the real Joker move. Whatever. So it's all strained out, and I have it in a bus tub because I had lost the original thing in the bottom of the soft serve machine, and I threw dry ice into it to try and cool it down faster, and of course it tasted lightly carbonated when it came out of the soft serve because the soft serve hadn't frozen out all the water in it, and so I had this kind of carbonated scrambled egg ice cream. It was the worst ice cream I've ever made in my entire life. I then threw an ice cream party afterwards, and quite smartly at the time, although it's a cop-out, and we'll talk about ways not to cop-out, I drove up to the Bronx to the Mr. Softy warehouse where the actual trucks for Mr. Softy go. And I said, I'm not trying to horn in on Mr. Softy's business. I have this ice cream machine. My wife's going to make me throw it away in about a week and a half. I'm going to have a big party. I'll pay whatever you want. Just let me buy like 5 gallons of Mr. Softy mix. And they did. They let me buy. It wasn't that much. I mean, the guy, I was not used to it, to like a normal non-Mr. Softy guy showing up at the window where the Mr. Softy trucks show up to buy their stuff and like kind of making this plea. And I guess he obviously looked at me and was like, this person is not a professional person in any sort of way. And so he sold me the stuff. Party was insane. Party was nuts. We went through so much soft serve ice cream on that. But that said, I'm sure you want to make it the right way. The first thing to do if you've never made huge batches before is make them in smaller batches so that you don't do the stupid stuff that I did. Second, if you have an immersion circulator, I would just make it an immersion circulator in kind of two liters at a time and just build it up 2, 3 to 4 liters at a time in bags and build up that way because you're much less likely to have a problem. It'll take you a little bit longer, but it's easier to chill and easier to keep done. That said, if you want to know about the actual formulation of soft serve, the problem overrun in a soft serve ice cream machine isn't achieved the same way that you achieve overrun in regular ice cream with the churning thing. The way that soft serve literally injects air into the freezing cylinder at the same time that it injects the mixture in. So you change the overrun based on the orifice. If you look in the soft serve machine, there is a pump. The pump draws the base out of the at least the one I had, out of the bottom of the unit and injects it into the chamber through what looks like, you know, a MIG welding tip, a little orifice, and you change that orifice size to change the overrun. And so unscrupulous people who are making soft serve, what they'll do is they'll put an orifice in there that increases the overrun to like 100% or more so that you're getting more than, you know, more air than you are ice cream base in the finished product. Conversely, you can do a super premium one by reducing the overrun by changing the orifice in it, which is what companies like Carvel do. So Carvel, you know, it's not super premium anymore by, you know, modern standards, but, you know, back in the 70s, they had a very low overrun ice cream that was still soft serve. That's why Carvel cakes, once they're hardened, are dense as hell, because it's actually a very dense ice cream, which is why I like Carvel. And I, you know, whatever their flavoring is, I learned to love it when I was a kid, so I have no idea whether it's actually good or not. Right? Mm-hmm. But you didn't grow up with Carvel. Do you like it?
It's okay. Yeah,
but you didn't grow up with it. So it's like black and white cookies. If you didn't grow up with a black and white cookie, you don't love a black and white cookie. Jack, you grew up with black and white. So we had this conversation last week?
Yeah.
Yeah, black and white.
Of course.
Yeah. Okay. So, anywho. So the point is the overrun is controlled by the orifice. So you can go buy a new orifice, and they're fairly inexpensive. So whatever make you have, you can easily go buy the orifice to produce the overrun you want. The trick with soft serve machines is that you have to adjust. You have to remember that they're going to be served slightly warmer than a hard ice cream. So sugar levels need to be a little bit different. And what you need to guard against is over whipping, because this thing sits there churning the entire time, even when you're not drawing. At least I believe that they always churn even when they're not drawing. So there's the issue that something might be in the cylinder much longer than it would be in a normal machine, and so you need to add emulsifiers to it to prevent over whipping in the cylinder as it goes. Now, a good place to go for this kind of information, if you just Google soft serve Guelph, G-U-E-L-P-H, which is where the university is that does a lot of the good dairy science stuff that's available on the web, and Goff, G-O-F-F, which is the professor's name, there's a huge PDF that you can look at on the internets that deals very specifically with all of the different all of the different things that go into soft serve, including the fact that you want a higher non-milk fat solids, that's what it is, in ice cream, because you're not going to have lactose crystallization problems over time, and it increases the body of it. They talk about the fat content, and they actually give some proportions that you might want to use, and then you're just going to go out and get some good emulsifiers. I mean, I'm sure egg yolks are good enough to emulsify them to prevent the overchurning, and they talk about fat contents and everything. So just go on to that, and they actually talk about changing the wetness or dryness perception of the ice cream based on whether you add certain salts. And this is something I never thought about before, that I'm going to do more research for the next time we do ice cream work, adding sodium citrate or different calcium to either make it wetter or drier, the ice cream. But I had no idea, so that's something to look into. You got to love Guelph. All right, so that's it. And shout out to John Riper, who says, Stas, sorry to hear that the apples didn't arrive in the best of shape, but glad you could still go to tasting with them.
Hey, John, the chocolates were delicious. He sent us chocolates.
Well, you see. And then I was told that I was throwing John under the bus, saying that, you know, that they didn't. It's not that they didn't come in the best of shape. You want to know exactly what our tasting stuff is. And I, for one, really appreciated it. And I thank you, John. Cooking issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.